The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It's my great, great delight and honor to introduce Michelle Zauner, who you probably best know as the musical artist behind the indie pop band Japanese Breakfast. Her albums include Psychopomp, Soft Sounds from Another Planet, and the Grammy-nominated Jubilee. She is also the author, as you well know, of the New York Times bestselling Crying in H-Mart, a memoir about loss, coming of age, and growing up as a biracial Korean American. Michelle graduated from Bryn Mawr College, where she studied film and creative writing. And in addition to being an acclaimed musician and author, she is an accomplished filmmaker, having directed many of her own music videos. And she is now adapting Crying in H-Mart into a screenplay for MGM's Orion Pictures. Bowen Yang of Saturday Night Live described Michelle thus: Michelle Zauner is my favorite kind of artist. She's one of those musicians, writers, vocalists, and cooks who has the ability to meld all her media into perfect concert with one another. To read her writing is to be reminded of her albums. To learn about her mother's life is to flash back to the dazzling visuals in her music videos. I agree 100% and couldn't be more delighted and proud to welcome who is perhaps my favorite student of all time, Michelle Zauner. Let's give her a warm welcome.
Now I feel like I really won.
So I have a number of questions for you, but I thought I would actually start us off with a Philly question since we're on home turf. You write in the book about how after you graduated from Bryn Mawr, you lived in Philly for 4 years and worked in the service industry. And I was wondering if you could tell us any stories about that time in your life.
Oh, yeah. Where to begin? I just remembered I worked at Yakitori Boy for a month, which was maybe the worst job I've ever had in my entire life. My job was basically, I was a cocktail waitress in the main room, which is where everyone gets really drunk and sings in public.
Horribly often.
And the worst part of it is that, you know, there are like a few tables there that everyone wants to sit at, but you have to like hit a quota of like $60 an hour as a group. And it's very complicated. And then it's even more complicated to try to explain that to drunk people who are trying to sit at those tables, how the system and quota works. And if you don't hit the $60 amount, then you have to pay this other fee. So you were basically like a human fly swatter for most of the night. So that was really awful. I worked at Raw Sushi, which I don't know exists anymore in Center City. And then I walked out. I forget why. Oh, you know what? They wanted to charge us if we ever broke a glass. That was going to take, not that I like broke a lot, but sometimes it just happened. And they were threatening that if you broke a water glass, you'd have to pay. First of all, they were like really flimsy water glasses. And if you broke it, they would take the money, it would out of your paycheck.
They should have paid you extra for the danger that they
yeah,
were putting
exactly,
you in.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, yeah, I had a lot of, and then of course I was at Sochi, which is like a Mexican fusion restaurant where I had to explain like what a deconstructed $20 tamale was, and that was also really awful.
any good Philly favorite places or fond memories?
I would say my favorite job that I ever had was working at Brave New Worlds, which is a comic book shop on 2nd Street. And yeah, I've never felt, next to the job I currently have, I would say That was my favorite job. My friend runs that comic book shop, and you're kind of a mini celebrity because the regulars will come in and treat you really favorably because you're like pulling their comics, and we had a lot of people who'd like bake us things and, you know, bring us treats from work and stuff.
Very nice. So I'd like to transition to asking you a bit about the film adaptation of Crying in H Mart. So it's super exciting. I see that you have Will Sharp attached as a director, who you may know from White Lotus season 2. He plays Ethan. Can you tell us how that collaboration came about?
Yeah, we had a couple of directors in mind. Obviously, we knew that the director would have to be Asian in some way. We ideally like wanted, you know, it's hard to find a director that sort of like ticks all of those boxes and is available and interested in the project. And so the pool is pretty small. And he was actually not on my radar at all. Apparently he gets asked to do a lot of projects, turns things down, and he actually reached out to us about really loving the book and wanting to know more about the adaptation. And so I think that like exclusivity element was really intriguing to me. And, you know, he's half Japanese and half British, and I went in a deep dive and watched his BBC show Flowers and Landscapers, and I just thought that he had a really interesting cinematic voice. Like, I just really, you know, I thought that, like, especially as a great actor with, like, really great range, he was also, he plays so many different roles. He plays Shun in Flowers, and he plays Rodney in Girihachi. It's really amazing to see his range, and so I knew one of my major shortcomings as, like, a sort of advisor on this project was I don't know anything about the theater world or, you know, drama in that way. And so I really wanted to work with someone who had a real understanding of actors and what it is that they want to say, what makes a character really exciting to play. And that's been a really wonderful part of that collaboration, is slowly starting to think, like, how do you get actors to want to be in your movie, and learning what lines are the things that sort of draw people into a character. And I think that he's been really, yeah, he's really opened my eyes to that.
That's something that Rodney Evans, who teaches film at Swarthmore, emphasizes, is how important it is for directors to have acting experience and understand how to work with actors, and that's a different component of the creative process. I was also wondering, so there's no connection to Michael Imperioli, who was also in White Lotus your video, Savage Good Boy.
Yeah, I saw a tweet that was saying Michelle's collecting White Lotus characters like they're in Infinity Stones. And it's totally unrelated. I'm just a huge Michael Imperioli fan because of The Sopranos. I'm a major Sopranos fan, and you know, if he was alive, I think James Gandolfini would have been a perfect actor for my father's character. But yeah, I mean, I just love Michael Imperioli, and my friend Spencer, who's in this band, Charlie Bliss, would always like repost his Instagram because he's just like such a head. Like he really loves like Moses Sumney and Slow Dive, and like he's just like such a punk. And we thought that like maybe we had a shot at getting him to play that kind of role. He's also just aged like a real fine wine, and I just felt like he would be so great in that role. And this was, I think, right before he went to Italy to shoot the show. So yeah, that was total coincidence.
And so on that topic, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your music videos and how there are these motifs that, as Bowen Yang said, connect up to other aspects of your practice. We have the banquet table in Savage Good Boy, and we have the supermarket, the sort of vampiric you gliding through a supermarket, which of course makes one think of H Mart. Can you talk a little bit about those motifs in your work?
Yeah. For the supermarket, we really wanted to shoot in H Mart and couldn't quite get it together. We ended up shooting in a supermarket in Los Angeles. I forget the name, but it's the same one that they use in A Star Is Born. Like mostly I think they get, that's where they buy the peas. and they sit outside. But yeah, that video was, I mean, most of the videos are there's some like sort of, I love to like connect them with like various sort of Easter eggs. I mean, that wasn't complete, those two videos were, at least Posing in Bondage was a complete accident and a result of like a not so great producer situation, honestly. I was supposed to be slow dancing with a robot in the supermarket. And the producer was like, oh, so the production, it's very guerrilla like DIY music video making. And we had everything together for Savage Good Boy, which was supposed to be like this, you know, this, I guess kind of like I was interested in this headline I read about billionaires buying bunkers. And I thought that's like such a menacing reality of our time, and what would it be like to write a song from that perspective of a billionaire trying to coax a young woman to marry him and live with him in safety, and kind of like Connor and Willa in Succession.
Yes.
Yeah, so that video went swimmingly, and then when it came to Posing in Bondage, the whole week leading up to it, I'm like, where is this robot? Like, we haven't seen it. I think it's going to be challenging. And our production designer was kind of like, oh, no, it's under control. Like, you know, don't worry about it. And I was like, well, I haven't even seen it. Like, we have to know what it looks like if we're even going to use it. And then on the day of, I finally got it out of her that it fell through.
Robot.
Yeah, there was no robot. So I had to like think really quickly on my feet, and I was like, okay, I have this like weird outfit, I have this hoverboard, I have a grocery store, I have this crew, I have film, I have a camera. And I decided that I would create this sort of like prologue to, or epilogue to like Savage Good Boy that came before, like The Hobbit, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how they would connect. So they were sort of like accidentally very linked in that way.
Cool. Regarding the adaptation of this book, I'm wondering if you thought about narrative structure at all. Is it going to be chronological? Is it flashback? Is there voiceover? I'm just curious about the kinds of choices that you're working with.
This is great. I'm in like screenplay hell right now, but it's really lovely getting to talk to you about it in this way. I really hate flashbacks, and I love voiceover, but I think I was so afraid to do voiceover because I was just afraid. I went in first trying to be very unauthorly about it because I felt like everyone had this expectation of authors that come in to adapt their own work, and they write really flowery and they kind of like explain sort of too much. And so I was very sparse. Mm-hmm. And then after the first draft, my producer was like, well, we kind of have to know what they're feeling at some point in time. And I was like, oh, all right, okay, got it. And so, it's such a different process than writing a book because I feel like a book you can end on so many questions, and that's okay, and that's part of it. And a screenplay has to really make like a declarative statement. You have to know exactly what you're doing before starting. And I feel like that's the sort of opposite advice I got for writing a book, where, you know, at Bryn Mawr with Dan, I feel like I've always felt like outlining was kind of avoiding the work, and that it's best to kind of let your characters or the story sort of guide you and you know, have mysteries, you know, arise. And with a screenplay, they're very intent on knowing the outline and what all of the beats are, seeing a very clear arc and knowing all of the scenes before you even go in to write them, which was very different and was a fun part of it. So it's been very different. I really love, so far, I don't know if it's too revealing, I don't know if it will stay this way, but I really love, I love the almost famous plot structure where, you know, you get sort of 10 pages of his life before we enter the present, to sort of see what his childhood was like and what maybe sort of made him the kind of person he was 10 minutes later into the film. So that was the kind of model I went in for the screenplay, was, you know, you spend sort of the first 10 to 15 pages, like seeing my childhood and visiting Korea and my mother's family, and then you kind of go into her teenage years when things are a little bit difficult, and then the rest of the movie is in the present. That's what it is right now, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, no, I mean, that's, it's just such an interesting...
And by her, I mean me.
Yeah. Just the creative challenges there where you have some, like, strict limitations on the one hand that are about, like, production and... You have to know, like, exactly how many locations there are and all
of
this, like,
that's been a real eye-opening process of just, like, do you really need to see a plane take off? Because that's, like, $100,000 or something.
Yeah.
Or, like, there's a brief scene where, like, my mom, like, we're flipping through my mom's CD deck and a Bruno Mars song comes on. And it was mostly just because of the joke that my mom would call it Bruno Mar. And... They were like, that's going to be at least $100,000. And I was like, okay, we don't need we don't need that.
Yeah, yeah. Don't spend that on Bruno Mars.
Yeah.
Bruno Mars. Yeah. No, and that's actually...
Like, that joke is not worth that amount of money.
Yeah. And that's, as a fellow, like, biracial Asian white person with an immigrant parent, I love those little moments in your book where you talk about, like, the steamy hot
and
these kind of neologisms that our parents would come up with. I would like to actually ask you a couple questions about grief, if that's okay. So this book is many things. It's a coming-of-age story. It's a memoir. It's an artist's, you know, self-autobiography. But it's also a grief book, and I think it's useful to people as a grief book. And anyone who's gone through a major loss will find something to relate to. And so I'm wondering if, first of all, when you were grieving, were there books or films or anything that helped you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, I felt like such a... I don't know if I, like, really wanted to interact with that at the time. At the time, I was just, like, playing... like farming simulation games and like various adult pacifiers like that. But, you know, I think later on, I mean, I really loved, when I was writing this book, when I was preparing to write this book, certainly Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking and Blue Nights were really informative. I feel like this book, you know, doesn't get its due, but I really love Cheryl Strayed's Wild, and that was, we shared an editor, and you know, I think that we both sort of turn to, like, these types of alternative forms of therapy to grieve, and I really loved that book. I think that it's really haunting and beautifully written, and maybe because it's so popular, it doesn't get its, like, literary due. And yeah, I mean, album-wise, I still love, and my husband is so tired of this album, but Carrie and Lowell, Sufjan Stevens' Carrie and Lowell, especially, because, you know, he has a complicated relationship with his mother who died, and he spent so much of his childhood in Eugene, Oregon, which is, like, such an odd thing to share with someone, and that album is so beautiful to me and has definitely helped me through some stuff.
Do you feel like you're at a different place now with your grieving process than you were when you wrote this book?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think a big part of it is just time, you know? I don't know if I enjoy my grief, but I certainly have come to a type of peace with it, and it's weirdly comforting when it still overwhelms me, you know, in this way that it used to just be so overwhelming that it was difficult to function or see a life out alongside it. And I think now it is just a part of my life that I embrace, because I think it's really beautiful to have loved someone and to have been loved by someone so deeply that when they're gone, you carry that pain with you. And so, yeah, I think it's actually, especially because of my work that deals so personally with this loss, and because I talk about it so openly all the time, that there is this fear that, you know, you're losing touch of some of that emotion because it's so on display for the world. And so when I have a moment of real pure grief privately, it is a really beautiful thing to, like, be reminded that that is still mine and will always be mine.
That's your 10%.
Yeah, that's my 10%.
Yeah, no, I remember in my own, when I lost my mother, it was for a long time, I had survivor guilt, and I felt like I wasn't supposed to enjoy or succeed or move on. And I was very attached, at the same time as it was a traumatic thing, I was very attached to not forgetting details of those last, you know, moments. And it took me so long to realize, oh, when I go on and enjoy and succeed, that's actually honoring my mother.
Yes, yes.
And that's just, it's a beautiful thing that you've done for her.
Yeah, and I think that part of it too is as you get older or as there's space between you and that loss, you can discover parts of them in you as you know. I mean, I never felt like I was really all that much like my mom. I really took over, like, I took after my dad, who's, like, very impatient and aggro and, like, such an oversharer. And so I never felt like I took after my mom as much as I wanted to. And, you know, now a lot of her sort of behaviors I find in myself as I get older, which can also be sort of dangerous because, you know, you start to romanticize some of their bad qualities too and are like, that's you, mom, you know.
Yeah, They become
instead of
the
trying
saint.
To fix them, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, just I want to end with some... I have some Asian questions. I'm like, grief questions, Asian questions. So you already answered the question about, was it important to you that the director of the film be Asian and in this case, even biracial? And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you identify. This is something that I have a challenge with as well. It's like when you can only check one box, like what do you check? Do you check Asian? Do you check other?
Oh, yeah. What do I check?
Yeah.
I'm an other. I feel like I've checked other. But yeah, it's been a while since I've had to do that. That's like more of a school thing, I think.
Yeah, and often now you can check multiple boxes, which didn't used to be
I've always
the case.
Identified as other.
All right. And then I wanted...
That's just me.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty other, too. So, when you came backstage earlier, I was doing Mandarin on my Duolingo. And
very sweet.
So I read somewhere, I think in an interview, that you were learning Korean, or rather brushing up your Korean. I assume as a heritage speaker, you've got a mixture of different... And that's a funny thing for me, too. It's like, I know all these words, but I was illiterate until recently. And so I'm wondering where you are with learning Korean and if you're still interested in perhaps living there.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting. And I was thinking about this the other day. Have you seen Return to Seoul yet?
No, we but just, somebody recommended it.
Yeah, it's great. I watched it last night and... There's a scene, I don't think this will spoil too much because it's like literally the first scene, but there's some mention of sight reading, when I was thinking about my own, it's interesting that you said you were illiterate until recently because it's almost like my skill set is almost like the opposite than a lot of people. Like, weirdly, I went to Korean school every Friday for like 10 years and I grew up, you know, I grew up hearing the language so much, and I spoke a lot of, like, Konglish at home and with my family. So I always felt, like, very comfortable, like, tonally with the language, and which is such a different experience. I have this, like, real bravado with, like, my sort of ownership of that language in the sense that when I go there, even if I don't know exactly what I'm saying, I feel really confident in sort of shouting it out, which is the total opposite with, like, when we go to Spain or something as a band, and after, like, 8 years of Spanish, I'm like, me llamo. Like, I get so... I'm so embarrassed and ashamed of, like, my parents. I have no confidence at all, which I think is such a huge part of language. And yeah, but all I got from my Korean school really was I learned how to read and write. And sort of similarly to music, I'm very dim-witted when it comes to music theory, but I've always been able to read music. Just like very, not necessarily sight read, but like very slow. I can read it slowly, and that's sort of where I'm at with Korean. But I'm really fascinated with the language. It feels like a very natural jumping off point from this book. And so Knopf reached out to me about if I wanted to do a second book with them. And my main passion has been I want to learn the language. And my mother always told me if I lived in Korea for 6 months to a year, she believed that I would be fluent in the language. And so next year, I am moving to Seoul on January 1st. And I'm going to live there for 1 year. And I'm going to start my second book documenting this process of, you know, I think a lot of people are sort of interested in, you know, especially when you're in your 30s and your brain is a little bit slower, like does, like how long, like how long does it take to, you know, is it possible still to kind of learn a new language?
Wait a decade and it gets worse. But
I just think it's really interesting. I mean, I remember I saw like American Utopia and, you know, one of the first things that David Byrne talks about is like when you're a baby, like all of your like synapses, this is not my field, but you know, all these like connections in your brain are open. And as you get older, they like shut down to focus on what is useful and, you know, to be a more efficient human being. And so I feel like my brain has like shut down in such a serious way to just focus on these jobs that I'm doing. And so it'll be interesting to kind of try to prod them back open when
I
get
and
there.
I do think it's possible, you know, it's, and there is a kind of similarity between learning a new language and learning a new musical instrument, or it's, some of it is just a matter of like rote practice and
totally. And
routine.
I mean, there's like English words as, you know, a native English speaker. I mean, I've learned the word like capricious like 20 times and I'm still like, it's like moody, like, you know, it's always, and so I'm just like, how are you going to like, yeah, how are you going to learn this language? And so I'm excited to sort of ask that question and figure it out. I also really love like all of the funny things that come from studying a language, like in Duolingo, where it's like, the owl wears sunglasses. And you're like, why do I need to know that?
The sentences are so weird in the Mandarin, like some of them are so easy. It'll be like, the cat is cute, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just like, yeah, I got that. And then it'll be like, oh, like on December 26th at 11:06 p.m., you know, will she go to the neighbor's house that is to the left of the hospital?
Right, exactly.
Like, like, I can't translate that.
My favorite one was, I am too beautiful for this conversation. It's like, I am going to incorporate that in my daily life.
Wow. On that note, too beautiful for the conversation. Why don't we open it up to the beautiful people in the audience?
How do you feel about the coat check being named after you?
Oh, yeah.
Positive. That was a really wonderful surprise. For those who might not know, one of my other many jobs in Philadelphia was working the union transfer coat check when it first opened. I also used to be the R5 Productions intern for many years, which was basically a fake job. And one time I took a fake $100 bill and made change, a lot of change. And the owner, or like the floor manager, was really upset and again wanted me to pay for just like the glasses, like wanted me to pay them back, which was a lot of money. It was like $100, like it was way more than I made on that shift, and it was a major bummer. And Sean Agnew, my old boss, like it's like a part owner of Union Transfer, and stepped in and was like, I'll pay the $100. And then like 5 years, 6-7 years later, we sold out 5 nights at Union Transfer. And I called Sean up and I was like, I have $100 for you. I can finally pay it back, I think. And I thought I was like the real hero of that story. And then after the show, I came out and they had hand painted like a sign that said Michelle's Honors coat check. And so he really one up to me. It's like my favorite. I mean, I think it's the highest honor. It's like the one of those like sort of full circle stories that make being a musician like really just so wonderful and really reminds you of where you came from and forces everyone to remember it too.
Sweet revenge.
Yeah. And as a Korean, that is very important to me.
Hi, I'm also an other, and I have an aging Korean mom right now. So reading this was probably one of the hardest things, but amazing at the same time. So after everything that you've experienced and kind of from your perspective now, you know, I'm concerned about when my mom is gone, my tie to that part of my culture is gone. So do you have any advice for somebody who is kind of entering that part of her life?
Yeah, I mean, I think looking back, I wish, you know, I had asked everything that I wanted to ask. And, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of Asian cultures are so weirdly evasive about that kind of stuff. Like, a lot of our parents are really private people, and they don't think that their stories are very important, and so they're withheld from us. And so I think that it takes a lot of extra badgering to, like, get detail from their life in that way.
A month ago that my mom had a, like, sibling that died when he was, like, right. 3 years
yeah.
old. Like, I had
yeah.
no idea.
Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who's, like, a dad's, like, heart has been aching for, like, a year, and he just went in for, like, heart failure and just, like, did not tell his family. I think there is just something to a lot of Asian culture or a lot of immigrant cultures that are like that in general. So, yeah, I mean, I think just, like, listening and you know, pressuring them to kind of share the things that you want to know and acknowledging that. I mean, it's not just other cultures. Like, I think that anyone, a lot of times we just don't want to acknowledge that, like, we're all going to die, you know, and that that it's important to, like, what do we want to know before that happens? And, yeah, I would say just asking questions and writing them down, yeah.
This might be a stupid question, but I was just wondering, why did
is that the question?
No, okay. I was going to ask, why did you name your band Japanese Breakfast
oh, yeah.
instead
okay,
of
cool.
Korean Breakfast?
Yeah. I was in Little Big League at the time, which was my old band, and I started, like, a lo-fi side project where I was just uploading songs onto Tumblr, and a lot of the Tumblr pages that I followed had, like, animated GIFs of food, and one of them was, like, an animated Japanese breakfast set, and I just thought, what a beautiful image, like, what a beautiful connotation. Not thinking that I would be stuck with this band name for so long. It was really like, I had no real ambition for that project at all, and it was just kind of a thing to name the Tumblr that I was uploading these songs onto, not thinking that I would have to answer this question in earnest.
For the rest of your life.
For, like, the next 10 years. And now it's like, it feels a little too late to change it, but maybe I will someday.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
I just have to ask what your favorite Korean dish is and what you're excited to eat when you go to Seoul.
Oh, yeah. I'm really excited. I mean, I'm excited to eat everything in Seoul. It's funny because, like, things are simultaneously, like, way more authentic, obviously, there, but they're also, like, way more perverse in the way that, like, they're fused to other things. So, like, loje tteokbokki, like, is basically, like, rosé carbonara rice cakes, which I really enjoy over there. And then kangjang kaejang, obviously, is like so, it's like raw fermented crab, is so hard to find in the States if you're not in, like, LA. So yeah, that's what I'm most excited to eat. Kimchi jjigae is, like, probably my favorite Korean food till death, to this part.
Hello, big fan. As a Korean American, I felt so seen when I read your book, like, down to the creepy, you'd clean up the house and they were gone to, like,
oh,
make
yeah.
them proud of you, and that
yeah.
was like, get out of my brain. But I think as someone who grew up with, like, really strict Korean parents and then went a creative route, and I'm actually a chef now.
Oh, wow.
I didn't realize until I got in my 40s.
Where do you work?
Huh? I work at Penn.
At where?
At University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
I'm in the Quaker kitchen. I'm in the teaching kitchen.
Oh,
anyway,
cool.
That's neither here nor there.
I was like,
but
what is your restaurant?
I would love to feed you. But my question is, I didn't realize that I had the courage to not be a doctor or lawyer and pursue an unconventional, low-paying, not glamorous job. The reason I was able to do it is because no matter what happened and no matter how disappointed my parents were in me, I never questioned their love and support. And I feel like you're the superstar in all these different creative realms, and the love and support of your mother was always constant. So do you think that you would have been able to do everything you've been able to do without that love and support, which is very unusual because you went into such creative fields?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, my mom definitely did not support my path. And I understand that. I think most parents, when their kid's like, I want to be a rock star, is like, listen, kid. But, you know, my mom, I think, took it a step further and was just like, it's my duty to, like, really let you know how unrealistic and challenging and that's going to be. I mean, my mom, like, kicked me out of the house. Like, I was not, she was really not into this music thing. And I think, in a way, like, I just wanted it. So I tried, you know, so many times to, like, put it away. And, you know, for a long time, I thought I wanted to be a journalist because I liked writing, and I had to try to find this way to make everything practical. You know, when I was at Bryn Mawr, my major was in creative production. Like, it was a film studies and creative writing major, which are, like, the two most impractical things that you can put together, and it's exactly what I do for a living, you know? I told you so, but... You know, I think in a way, like, if I had an easy route to it, like, if I had all of that support, I don't know if I would have worked as hard. Like, I don't know if I, and so much of, like, where I'm at is because of just, like, my persistence. Like, and I don't think that I would have had that if I had, from a very young age, it sort of barred from me. Like, I think my mom was always like, if you're gonna do that, you will be getting no support. No financial support, no emotional encouragement. And I still was like, it's for me. Like, I want to sleep on that floor full of cat shit. And I want to sleep, you know, I want to, like, be playing in a basement for, like, 20 dudes, like, drinking 40s. Like, that's what I want to do with my life. And, you know, that's, I think that I don't think I would have had that, like, fortitude if I didn't, if in a way, if she hadn't sort of been like, don't do it. And then it's so funny because years later, I actually went back to Korea and we played a festival in Incheon. And I went to my aunt's house after, this was for the first time after she read the book in Korean, there's a Korean translation now. And she was so excited to talk to me. She, like, pulled out this, like, piece of scrap paper and was like, your great grandfather was a very famous voice actor. Your great great grandfather was a very famous voice actor. When the talkies, or not talkies, when the silent films came over, they would hire, like, one voice actor to do all of the voices for the actors, and that was his job. Your great grandfather did the same thing. Your grandfather was in, played King Sejong in, like, these radio plays. My aunt is a voice actor, and she drew all these lines, and it all ended in me, and you're, like, you were a descendant of, like, all of these artists. And I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? My whole life, my mom's, like, made me feel like a crazy person for having these ideas, and all along I come from this legacy of artists, like, now that I'm successful, like, sure. So yeah, I mean, it's such a bittersweet thing that they just, like, withhold from you until it's convenient.
Hi, I'm a fellow Hanguk Hakyo dropout.
Oh, yeah.
And half Korean. Something that I've been connecting with lately is watching K-dramas.
Yeah.
Not only to, like, learn the language, but also realize that all of these, like, toxic dynamics are actually very cultural that I didn't realize, like, the withholding the love and bottling everything up. Like, all of those things that are, like, distinctly Korean, and I just didn't know. I just thought it was, like, my fucked up family or something.
Totally.
Anyways, so are there any K-dramas that you've been enjoying watching?
Yeah. That's great. I haven't really watched that many K-dramas. I'm really looking forward to, like, fully immersing myself in that next year. The closest I've gotten to a K-drama was watching Singles Inferno. Did anyone else watch that? Yeah. And it's, like, the best kind of TV because you're like, oh, this is educational. Like, I'm learning Korean by watching Singles Inferno. It's, like, it's cultural connections. But, yeah, that's about it. And, you know, that's, like, toxic in its own special way, too.
It's been very enlightening.
Yes, yeah, yeah. You're like, that's why my mom was, like, chasing me with sunscreen all the time. It was, like, awful colorism.
Hi, I'm a big fan of
you. Thank you.
It's just, I have a junior daughter now in high school, so I'm going a
so you're in it.
Yes, I'm I'm going around a lot of college tours, so I just it just set up like a Bryn Mawr College in procession at first with the professor and his best student. So my question is, how did you choose the school to come here?
Oh, this is so and, sweet.
and if you what really changed that you learned from Bryn Mawr and your teachers?
Oh, that's so sweet. And then
I just went to H Mart today and I have a little gift for you.
Oh my God! Wow! Oh my God.
So sweet.
Oh my goodness. Wow, thank you so much. Oh my gosh. Wow, thank you.
감사합니다.
Mommy mom.
Yeah, really. Wow. I had a, you know, neither one of my parents went to college, and we were a bit clueless when it came to it. We had a college counselor that helped us quite a bit. I was like a very independent spirit, as you might guess, from a very early age, and she really felt that a liberal arts college was a really good environment for me, and she told us about the Seven Sisters schools, and I was really drawn to attending a Seven Sisters college because I liked the opportunity to be in a consortium where you had the opportunity to go to all these other schools, and I also I just really wanted to be in this kind of community of women. I felt very empowered by that idea, and it felt, you know, I don't know. I just was drawn to it. So I mostly applied to Seven Sister colleges. I really wanted to go to Barnard. I was rejected. But now they teach Crying in H Mart in their courses. So I've heard, yeah. I've met some Barnard students who've told me that they've read Crying in H Mart in their classes. So I won. And but I went, I was between Smith College and Bryn Mawr mostly. And then Smith was like kind of a little too in the middle of nowhere. And Bryn Mawr is like such a beautiful campus. And I think I sat in on a creative writing class and really enjoyed it. I met two young women who were going to be freshmen there and really bonded with them. So yeah, I was just really drawn to the campus. I honestly hated my experience there initially because I thought it was going to be more alternative. I thought it was going to be a little like punker and thought we were going to be all in Riot Girl bands and making zines.
That was like.
I wanted more of like homemade college experience. But I realized that like if I wanted, I had really great professors. I think pretty early on, I think one of the first courses I took was Homé's Introduction to Film, not even knowing like how much I really adored film. And I mean, I had this experience with Homé, and I had this experience with Professor Daniel Torde, who was my creative writing professor, where I was just like, every day I would leave and it felt like my brain was like bursting at the seams. It felt like it was like expanding, and I was so excited to go to Homé's classes and to Dan's classes. And I just decided like if I could just take only Homé's classes and only Dan's classes, like I would be in good shape. And I'm so lucky that, you know, because I went to a liberal arts college and because our classes were quite small, and I could develop like such a long time friendship with my, you know, two professors who have deeply changed my life, and you know, I'm obviously still in touch with. And so I think that is such an essential part of looking for a school for your daughter is finding a college where you know the professors really care, because that's really all that matters, is that you have really great educators. Homé, like I mean, to see like a half Asian woman just like have such a command in her lectures was just awe-inspiring. Every day I was so excited to go to her class. And I remember one time I saw you at the train station, and it was like celebrity, like I was you know, she was wearing like all black, and she like looked just so cool, and she's like waiting for the train, and I was just like, oh my God. And I came out like, she's like, can't wait to grow up to be just like Homé. And actually, I remember I got my photo taken. I was like in the UK. This was like way too long ago for this to be my author photo. When I had this picture taken in the UK on our first tour, I was like, I look like Homé King.
And I was like, if I ever write a book, like, this is my author jacket photo. And I was like, dressed like you, and I feel like I like look kind of, I was like posing kind of like
cry.
You.
So
and that
sweet.
Was like why I picked my author photo. I think if you like look at my Facebook like from like 6 years ago, I'm like, I look like Homemade King. This is gonna be my author photo.
So
yeah, I would
sweet.
Say like, you know, I mean, definitely visiting the colleges, definitely finding colleges that are that have like small courses, like so you can really have develop those types of relationships with your professors, because it's such a it's an enormous part of like understanding the sort of world to come after you exit college. So yeah.
Well, thank you. And I was gonna just share a memory of you, because I remember you in that intro to film course, and you sat,
like...
you would sit like in the front row, but all the way to the side. So
it
didn't
scare you.
You're like, I'm eager and I'm attentive, but I'm not like so uncool that I'll sit front and center. And you loved all the weird films. Like you loved Fassbender and you loved Chungking Express. I don't think you had ever seen a Wong Kar-wai film.
I'd never
film
seen a
before.
Wong Kar-wai film, and it's like it's a director I rip off all the time now in all of our music videos because of you. So yeah, it was a huge influence on me. And yeah, I mean, I truly believe that like Homemade and Dan Torde changed my life in a huge way. I would not be the artist I am without them. And I've never felt that way about. I honestly, I've never had that experience with a teacher before attending college, I don't think. And so that was a true gift and what one should look for in a school, yeah.
Hey, I really loved your book. One thing that I really loved about it was that one scene where you were talking to your then boyfriend and you were telling him to kind of like propose to you.
Yes.
But you had that specific line where you were saying like, you know, if this was something that you thought you could see you doing in like 5 years or so, like you don't think you'd be able to forgive him if he didn't do it then so your mother could see it. And that struck me as just incredibly brave. And I was just wondering, like, was there any like pushback or like hesitation when you were like thinking about putting that in, seeing as it impacts your relationship now?
Oh yeah. Was I ever hesitant about putting it in into the book because it made my marriage look bad?
Like people can misconstrue it or something like that.
Oh yeah, for being bossy, for being too bossy. Honestly, that's the first time I even considered not. Maybe like I should have hesitated in putting that in there. Yeah, my husband and like his entire family are here somewhere, and yeah, there they are. There they are. And yeah, I mean, honestly, I guess like if you know us, like it is so, it's very like us. Like, I always make fun of my husband now because his like buffer speed just like takes, like, you know, sometimes it just takes him longer to get there. You know, it took him a full year to realize that he loved me to begin with. So like, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he was... You know, it was a weird request, and at the time, like, I thought I was really a little weird and alone in that. I thought it was, like, very original idea, and so only to learn, like, you know, the personal being so universal, that so many people try to have weddings before their parent dies, that's, like, a very normal, desire and intuition. But yeah, I mean, I think if anything, it's just such a huge part of our story. And I mean, we're really lucky that it went so well. I really just wasn't thinking at the time, you know? Like, I think it just came out of like such a dark moment where, you know, like my mom, it just felt like we had lost everything and everything was so dark. And so much of caregiving, at least in cancer, is like pretending that everything is gonna get better. And having like such a strong hope that you're gonna beat something, even against like insurmountable odds, you have to like completely delude yourself into thinking like we're gonna get better. And when we finally had to accept that there was nothing to look forward to, I think that sort of desire just came to like have like something beautiful and something good and something.
you know, for my mom to not be thinking about like a new side effect, but like what kind of chair we're gonna have, or like, you know, instead of like what can't I eat right now, like what's gonna be at the buffet table and what's the color scheme, what's the flower gonna be like. I think I just want, it was like a major like distraction, and yeah, I'm just really lucky. I had like a really wonderful partner who was like down for the ride, and I have to really thank my wonderful in-laws too, who like weren't like, you're fucking crazy, and had, you know, they were, you know, like, it's pretty wild out of nowhere to be like, oh, we're getting married in 3 weeks, or, and yeah, I'm just really lucky. I mean, it was such a beautiful experience. Because in ways I couldn't have even imagined, you know, like, because I think that when you become, when once we were married, we were in each other's families in this way that we were able to really be a part of each other's lives, in this way that I did not expect a sort of opening up to us. And that was really important when my family was kind of falling apart, to be like so lovingly welcomed into his family. And they're all here now, and I'm very, very blessed to be a part of that family. So I don't know, that was out of all of the things that gave me pause to put in the book, that wasn't really one of them, because I think it's a very funny story and very us. Yeah.
All right, I guess we're out of time. Let's all thank Michelle.
Thank you, Philly.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.